The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. And thanks to Adam, who sent me some possible headlines. Football is going home. Good. You say hierro. I say goodbye. Not as good. But both mean the same thing. Spain, like Germany and Argentina before them, are out. And the easy side of the draw just got a little bit easier. But perhaps not quite as easy as it could have been, as Croatia sneaked past Denmark in a pretty tedious game until the last 5 minutes of extra time. We'll answer your questions and we'll look ahead to tomorrow's games as well. And that's today's Guardian World Cup Football Daily. We have a panel today. Hello, Greg Bukowski. How are you?
I'm all right, Max, yeah.
Nice to see you. How's your World Cup been so far?
It's been very good.
Here's a question from someone, I haven't got their name, but it just says, how often does Greg eat pasties from Greg's?
Ooh, I've had one this year, I'd say. Okay. Steak bake.
Did you enjoy it?
It was all right. I mean, I remember them more fondly from many years ago, yeah. Also, Greg's weren't big down south for some years, and they have made that move and become, you know, they've expanded, and I'm not quite sure they brought the quality down from the north.
No, I understand that. Paolo Bandini, nice to see you.
Hey.
Here's a question from Manny. Says, which of these Serie A players has most impressed Paolo during this World Cup?
The one that springs to mind actually is Diego Laxalt for Uruguay. I think that in the first couple of games of this tournament, when he wasn't in the side, you saw a much more cautious version of that Uruguay team. In the last couple, Tabarez has moved Caceres, another Serie A player, over to right back, and you've got Laxalt playing at left back. And I think because he naturally plays at wing back for Genoa, and he's so much more of an aggressive player, so much more willing to carry them forward. I think it's really made that whole Uruguay team much more dynamic. You saw it in the Russia game, and I thought the way they played even in the last 16 game against Portugal was just that little bit bolder, that little bit more confident in possession rather than just protecting themselves first. I think he's really changed the balance of that team. So he's the one who stands out for me at the moment.
All right. Well, two games today, two penalty shootouts. Nick says, to honour today's games, will the pod be mostly quite disappointing with the contributors not really performing to their potential with a bit of forced excitement at the end? We'll start with the Russia-Spain. Is that an accurate way to describe that game?
Yeah, definitely. I think people expected a lot more of Spain. They weren't great in the group stages, but they showed in flashes that they could, they had a bit of verve in their attack. I think it was hard to know how Costa was going to perform, but he didn't have the dynamism they needed up front, I don't think. So his movement wasn't quite good enough for players to pick the passes off. And also, I mean, they didn't play Andre Iniesta. That was a bold call, and it was probably proven to be the wrong call. Russia played as well as they could. They did everything they could. They made it hard for Spain, but I don't think Spain didn't play enough vertical passes. They were, you know, very, very sideways, and just didn't look to punch the holes through Russia's defence as they have in, you know, previous incarnations of that team.
You sort of wonder, Paolo, Spain would have seen Russia get demolished by Uruguay, and then they'll take an early lead, and they'll probably, you just go, wow, we've got this, lads, haven't we?
Yeah, I mean, I think the best analogy I've seen for this Spain team, which I am stealing from the excellent Musa Kwongo on Twitter, is that they're a novel without a good editor. This is a team that passed the ball 1,137 times in that game. I mean, they had a spectacular amount of possession, and they couldn't do anything with it. And I think that what you sort of alluded to there, to me, it comes down completely to the departure of Lopetegui on the eve of the tournament. I think you've got a team which everyone thought, because they've got all these great players, because they play together, a lot of them at club level, and know each other so well, because the international side has been playing a certain way for however long, they'll all just be able to work it out. We'll have enough of the ball and we'll work it out. And actually, sometimes you really bloody need a manager to make you something more than that. You need the person who's on the sideline observing it and going, all right, well, we've got all this possession, but we have to be a bit more clever about it. Because they weren't. They sort of just seemed to have this this idea. And frankly, when they went 1-0 up, I thought it as well. Once the ball goes in and they're winning 1-0, I think probably a good amount of the fans in that stadium thought, that's it, they're just going to suffocate it now. And Russia didn't sort of have a particularly expansive game plan. But there was nothing creative about it in the end, and it was just really sort of meaningless, all that possession.
Do you think, looking back to the qualifiers, I think there was one qualifier, wasn't there, when David Villa was brought back in from MLS, and that in itself was a kind of pointing towards this problem that Costa has never actually replaced Torres or Villa as, you know, as a more dynamic striker. He can do the work, but his runs perhaps aren't as clever as those were, and gave the options to midfielders in a way that he hasn't been able to do since he's been in the Spain setup. I'm not saying David Villa should have been in this World Cup squad, but I just think...
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because then you could draw an immediate parallel as well with Germany and Miroslav Klose. Mm. Like, as soon as you sort of take out these players who maybe seem at the time to not be your most sort of impressive player, your most sort of, I don't know, a delicate player, but they're the ones who lend that effectiveness to what
you're
doing.
They bring shape to the team.
Yeah.
I think, you know, Russia and Cheryshev have got a player who helps bring shape to them. And I think Spain lacked that.
There still is a question. I mean, after that own goal, which was sort of fairly comedy of a wrestling match between the two players, Ramos falling over and the ball ending up in the back of the net, there was a question about what is Piqué doing with a handball? That's not a natural position when you jump in the air, and you just don't do that. It didn't look like Russia were going to get back into that game, did it?
Paolo just put his hand up to answer that question in an unnatural style.
Yeah, he did.
Yes, I did. I was imitating.
A few players do this. Don't quite understand. I think there've been some dodgy handballs in this competition. Poulsen, the Denmark player, was, I think it was against Australia. There was another one where the player was sliding in. I can't remember who it was. But that was just a bit dumb, Paolo.
Yeah, but I think there's this a thing I want to say here, which is that the point when Russia score, you think Spain are in control of it. They still haven't actually had a shot on target at all at that point. Their goal had come from an own goal. But nevertheless, it does feel like there's been a degree of... A lot of Spain's wounds in this tournament have been self-inflicted. I mean, you think about David De Gea dropping the ball, giving away a goal. You think about the fact that David De Gea, I actually only just saw the number on this, he's made one save in the entire tournament. I mean, Spain, for a team that we think of as being quite robust, have managed to sort of find ways to undermine themselves over and over again. But yes, it's a stupid way to give away a penalty. And very possibly, if he doesn't give away that penalty, Russia never score, because Russia are not particularly well built to do it. They're not particularly well built to stand toe-to-toe with a team like Spain and play on Spain's terms. What they have proven themselves very adept at doing, and, you know, make your own, I guess... a European history gag here, draw the opposition into your territory and wait for them to give up hope.
I just wonder if I'm still working on the quality of international teams from when I was about 14, and now it isn't the case anymore. I mean, you look at the teams that have gone out. Whenever I look at a World Cup draw, I just presume that Argentina and Germany and Brazil and Spain and Italy and Holland, for that matter, will be the best teams in it. Mm. I mean, two of them didn't even make it here.
Well, I suppose you look at when you get to tournaments, a lot of doing well at a tournament is kind of building this. It's what Southgate's trying to do with England. He's trying to build this really, you know, happy environment and a kind of club side spirit about them. And you could say up until maybe tonight's performance by Croatia, they seem to have that about them. And, you know, England maybe to some extent, and Uruguay definitely, particularly given they've got two players at the back who play together. And I think in a way the smaller nations are using that to their advantage, perhaps because the smaller means they've got a tighter knit group of players who know each other better and maybe aren't as bloated and don't suffer from the weight of expectation in the way that the bigger nations like Brazil, Spain, Germany maybe do from back home. So I think it's working in the smaller nation's favour this time around, and as is the way the draws panned out as well.
A great stat from Jonathan Wilson. In 75 minutes plus injury time, during which Vladimir Granat was on the pitch for Russia, he attempted 5 passes and completed none of them. Yeah. on the basis of that statistic, could Russia win this World Cup, Paolo?
I mean, you know, having seen that same tweet from Jonathan, I went and pulled up the chalkboard on who scored. Yeah, I mean, Grant had an amazing game. He touched the ball a total of 12 times in that time on the pitch, which, again, sort of perspective for how much...
How many minutes was that in total?
So he was on from half-time, so that's 75 minutes.
Yeah.
In that time, so this isn't like the whole game stats, in that time, Isco touched the ball 119 times, Ramos touched 118 times, Jordi Alba touched 111 times. These are individual players for Spain who've touched it literally 10 times more than him. Which you'd think, again, he's a defender, right? That you'd think he'd be having to touch the ball a lot because Spain are supposed to be all over them. But again, just goes to show how sterile this possession was. And I think what you're sort of saying about old expectations of the big teams, I don't think that that's sort of was invalid before the tournament, to look at this Spain team that had been playing great under Lopetegui and think that they could do something. They were playing well. I think in their case, you can sort of say as an individual circumstance of a good manager being taken away from a team that prepared a certain way has probably hurt them, even in a way that I think a lot of people were maybe naive about when he went. And then you sort of have a question to ask for Spain. Was it still the right thing to do? To say to a manager who disrespected you as a sort of national federation, well, the principal thing is to say goodbye to you, even if it hurts us. But the thing that fascinates me a little bit, I know that some people have sort of pulled this up as the stat that proves it's coming home, that Pep Guardiola, the nation that he's been managing in, has been the nation that has won the World Cup for the last couple of cycles.
And, of course, the World Ploughing Championship was in Warwickshire in 66, amongst other things.
So I mean, the Pep Guardiola one, I don't think you should project it forward and therefore assuming anyone won the World Cup. But I do think there is maybe a little something in the idea that that, you know, Pep actually has himself moved on tactically, even in the time between those things, and what he's playing now at Man City, and indeed has benefited England a little bit, because there are some Man City players who've brought some of that to England. It doesn't mean that they're playing like Man City, but there is some of that. I think that to an extent Spain have looked a bit like they're still stuck in a past version of Spain, and I think tactics have moved on. I think it's been interesting at this World Cup, all sorts of things that are going on. Way more goals from set pieces than at past tournaments. I think the fact that these are more open games than at past tournaments, you're seeing higher scoring games than we've generally seen at World Cups. I think all of this is indicative, on some level, of the fact that the football has changed, as it always does. There's always a cycle. And I think maybe Spain, to me anyway, today in particular, look like they're still playing the football that ruled the world a few years back rather than right now.
Iniesta has retired from international football. 131 caps, 13 goals, one World Cup, two European Championships. Greg, if I'd offered that to you at the start of your footballing career, you'd have taken it?
Oh, I don't know. I mean, look where they are now, Max.
True, you're right. Yeah. And, you know, what did Iniesta ever do for Marine?
Exactly, yeah. He never played as a substitute in the FA Youth Cup third round. Anyway, he's what a player Iniesta is. And he's just... The way he could take a ball in any... You could have 5-6 players around him, and there's that showreel gallery that someone put together, which is just Iniesta surrounded by players. And he's just... I mean, such a brave player. He's not a brave player like, you know, your roaring English types, but he just takes the ball when there's men around him, and he knows he backs his own ability to be able to wriggle free and find a pass. And there's so few players like that. And perhaps what Paolo was alluding to there, Spain are still trying to play that way, but if he's not quite able to do that and they didn't have him in the team today, then maybe that doesn't work because other players aren't quite as good at doing that as he was and still is to some extent.
Frederick says, does Akinfeev's performance today in short sleeves on a previous pod, I said I didn't trust goalkeepers in short sleeves. They've done quite well today, I point out. Does it vindicate his performances for the last 12 years, Paolo? The last time he got a clean sheet was in about 1941, wasn't it? But look, he did what he was meant to do. He did well there, didn't he?
I mean, it's hard to knock someone who's had a long and ultimately, in the grand scheme of football, has pretty successful professional career. Why would you not think that towards the end of your career, having a fantastic occasion day that you never expected to have for your national team, winning a game that I think you could see very vividly from the Russian fans in the stadium just when it got to penalties. Before the penalties had been played, there was outright celebration from the Russian fans when it got to penalties. why wouldn't that be a beautiful moment in your career that sort of makes you feel like, hey, I've hung around and I've made it even more worthwhile.
Finnegan asks, Greg, is Sergio Ramos's barber a Liverpool supporter? Joe says, does Ramos's haircut win him captain of the shithousery 11? It was quite an interesting choice. Did he do that especially for today's game? I don't remember he had that before.
So I don't know. That was the haircut he chose to cry with, you know. I don't know. I mean, I'm sure there's lots of Liverpool fans who are very happy to see Ramos on the losing side.
You know. Yeah. Producer Jonathan has pointed out there was probably a potentially more important moment than Ramos's haircut, which was a free kick which went into the box. It looked like, was it Piqué and Ramos were both pulled over? It didn't go to VAR. VAR had a look, but they didn't tell the referee to look. A lot of people are now calling this, Vladimir assistant refereeing, that kind of bit. I mean, if Russia do win this World Cup, they won't get any credit at all anyway. But it did look like it should have been a penalty. It wasn't quite Panama on Harry Kane, but there was...
This isn't the Ramos one you're talking about, where, as it transpired from different angles, he had his arm around the player and it was kind of six of one, half a dozen of the other. But it was great Ramos dark arts again, in that he did it in a way that you could hardly see it. Is that the incident we're talking about?
The incident that I'm thinking of, if there's a replay that shows it as you've just described it, I personally haven't seen that replay. It doesn't mean it doesn't exist, because I would 100%
angle,
believe it.
It's a clear penalty and Ramos is being dragged down. From another one, you see that he's kind of grabbed on to the defender and kind of spun himself around to make it look like he's being fouled. And I think they were both at it. But
It was late on. It was the one where they all ran up to the ref afterwards.
Just Ramos who went down. No, as you say, it was Piqué as well. Yeah, I obviously haven't seen the replay that Greg's mentioning. It doesn't mean that it hasn't happened, because I can completely believe it.
The foul has become such
a key part of football.
Such a key part of football and such a skill these days, you know.
And wouldn't you back Ramos to be the first in the VAR era to work out that there's a way of gaming it? I'll say this about Ramos, though, you know, because king of shithousery, no question, but... I think in today, when we've seen two penalty shootouts, there was no one I was more certain was going to make his penalty than Ramos. He stepped up and I was like, yeah, this is going in. He just, that sort of goes with the territory, with his persona. He's got an arrogance and for many people an unlikability, but he absolutely has the conviction in himself that in situations like that you have to take your hat off to.
Yeah, if you got into bother in a bar and Ramos was with you, you'd know that he'd find a way to get you out there and for other people to be lying on the floor holding the
both of you are one body. Sentence away from saying you'd want him in your team. Wouldn't you? What did you think of the fourth sub after full time in extra time? This during the game completely passed me by, but Sal says it needs some tweaking. What if you only get to bring a fourth sub if you've had at least five shots on target before full time?
Yeah, why not? Let's see if we can confuse people more. No, I mean, I'm in favour of it.
Hang on, that happened.
Yeah,
yeah. I didn't realise that happened in that match. Yeah. But I remember in 2014 I wrote a blog about why that shouldn't happen.
Oh, why?
Because I just think it gives an advantage to just the bigger nations who've got greater pool of players. In the same way that it could. I mean, if it's then taken on into club football, which inevitably it will, because FIFA brings things into international football and they gravitate down to club football. If that happens, then it's going to, you know, if it happens in an FA Cup tie between a big Premier League team and a League Two team or something, they're going to have so much more on their bench that they can call on than that League
Two.
Yeah,
in the same way, and I don't follow rugby, so apologies to people listening who do follow it, in the same way that now you can basically make an entire team of substitutions, as far as I can tell. So if you are a minnow who has fought against a giant bunch of New Zealand oxes and then 60 minutes in they just bring a whole new set on to beat the living daylights out of you, it doesn't seem quite fair, does it? Luke says, do you think the England team should tour around England on a trophy parade or just stick to London?
I think it should be the whole of England, but I think it should be a non-stopping tour, so the bus just keeps going. And, you know, you could have some sort of hammock so they can sleep on it, but they just, you know, they don't get off until they've visited every town.
See, I always like, I turn up with every tournament with hope, Greg. And yeah. I haven't seen you since the World Cup started. I don't know. I imagine you're more of a realist than I am. But with every result on this side of the draw, you start going, well, hang on a second. I mean, it's not getting ludicrous because any of these teams, as Gary Neville correctly said on the commentary tonight, any one of these teams could beat us.
Well, Colombia probably will. And then all this talk about the great side. I mean, it is. The draw looks really appealing beyond Colombia, but that is a tough game. Like, Croatia against Argentina and Colombia, albeit against a very poor Poland, have been two of the, you know, the nicest attacking performances I've seen. And if Colombia play like that against any team, England included, I think there'll be trouble. And also, England rested an awful lot of players in that last game, as did Croatia in theirs, and that didn't quite work very well tonight. I know everyone goes on about momentum, this kind of stuff, but it didn't seem to work for Croatia.
I mean, I was sort of, as soon as Spain went out, I'd put a tweet out saying I found some of the immediate it's coming home talk to me didn't sit, because I always thought that Croatia, the way they played in this tournament, were going to get past Spain if it came to that. Having said that, Croatia, as we'll get on to, weren't as exciting and impressive tonight as I thought they were going to be. It is a fact now that we have six teams left on that side of the draw, of whom only two have ever played in a World Cup final, which is England and Sweden. There's four out of those six teams that have never played in a World Cup final. So we're going to have an interesting World Cup finalist one way or the other. Like, we're going to have someone who we're not accustomed to seeing there. It's
coming home. That's what you're trying to say. You just can't get it out.
I look at that side of the draw and I think that England have as absolutely as good a chance of anyone as getting to the final. That doesn't mean they're going to do it, but I think they have as good a chance as anyone outside of the draw.
All right. That'll do for part one. As we've alluded to already, in part two, we will discuss Croatia's victory over Denmark on penalties. Welcome to part two of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. There's a live show on July the 12th. Me, Barry, Philippe and Ellis looking ahead to the England-Uruguay World Cup final. So please come to the Emmanuel Centre and watch me panic, basically. And if we are out, watch Barry, Philippe and Ellis all laugh at me, actually. Okay, then. Croatia won, Denmark won. Croatia threw on penalties. You did the minute-by-minute of this, Greg. Yeah. I imagine the first 115 minutes weren't that exciting, but
The first 4 minutes were very exciting.
You're right, okay, first four are the last five.
It kind of ended up disappointing, like a Michael Mann film or something. You know, all the action was very early on. And then it fell flat. And Denmark struggled a lot in the first half. The fullbacks, the two championship fullbacks, Knudsen plays for Ipswich. And on the other side, Dahlgaard, who's at Brentford, I think. Yeah, they really struggled to get a handle on Perisic and Rebic. And they were just getting in behind them all the time. And it looked like it could go on to be a bloodbath. And it didn't materialise. Eventually, Denmark kind of just hung in there, played some very prosaic football and kind of launched it long at times. The ball didn't stick, but they did just hang in there. And then at half-time, they made a change, took Christensen off, went to a more conventional formation, didn't have three at the back, pushed the full-backs on and gave Perisic and Rebic something to worry about. And the second half was completely different. Mm. Denmark, you know, they don't have the fancy footballers that other teams have. They've got Eriksen, who's really good, who's as good as anybody. But they basically played well on the back of a tactical change and did the best they could with the limited ability they had, and almost beat Croatia. And they went close without kind of having a really clear cut chance. What I'm saying is, it wasn't the best game, Max.
No.
However, the Modric pass for Kramaric in extra time was wonderful. Like, there's oftentimes you can blame defenders for being too far apart. The two centre backs were really close, and still he threaded it through the eye of a needle to Kramaric, who was then brought down. My first impression was that, why is he not being sent off? And then you realise this rule change a few years ago has come in, by which if it's a genuine attempt to play the ball and it's still a goal scoring opportunity, then it's a booking and not a red card. However, this does feel particularly harsh in this situation, because Kramaric was literally 2 yards away and was cocking his foot to just slide it home when he was taken down. And you could see Jorgensen was genuinely attempting to play the ball, but it felt like justice wasn't done when Modric...
You think there should be triple jeopardy? Like if you've got a totally open goal, it's got to be a red.
At that time in the game, but Jorgensen was completely honest. You could see he really was trying to play the ball. And at first I just thought, he should just go, because it just felt like he deserved to go. And then it went to penalties and Croatia won.
And I love that when he was there, like Schmeichel, who played fantastically, obviously had a fantastic penalty shootout, say the Modric penalty even before that, has had a genuinely brilliant tournament, I think, Kasper Schmeichel. But I love his sort of desire to fight every argument. And as you said, you know, Christensen's down, he's not complaining, he's not protesting at all. Mm. But Schmeichel immediately is up in the referee's face, doing the VAR signal. Yeah. Like this is completely all over it. For me, I thought Gary Neville actually did a really great job of analysing how this game changed on ITV. He was talking about how when Schürrle came on at half time, he basically created a separation between the midfield and then as you were talking about the wingers and how they're getting, he created a separation between the midfield and the wingers and Rebic, and suddenly there was just Luka Modric got lost, I think, for a big part in the middle of that game, in between those lines and trying to work out where he was supposed to be. It's actually exactly what happened in their first game. Denmark, I think it was maybe a little bit before halftime, but had a very similar substitution against Peru. Schürrle came on late in the first half at a point when they were really struggling in that game, and actually things really steadied and turned. But yeah, it perhaps highlights the limitations of this Croatia team that they...
Because they look so good, didn't they? And the group, everyone was in the group, so it was like, oh, hang on, Croatia are really... They're up there with the favourites now, the way they've played football.
And I think Rebic and Perisic, just the way they played against Argentina as well, they're like, they're such aggressive wingers. Like they, you know, you get wingers who are a bit fancy now and again, but aren't aggressive. They are aggressive and really get in your face and push high up. And I think Denmark's manager, Arda Hareide, his tactical change to nullify their threat and push them back was brilliant, and it's a hat tip to him for showing the way for other teams who will face Croatia now, because there'll be better teams that face Croatia and will fancy the chances now they've seen how you can actually stop them playing.
It's the easy side of the draw, isn't it? But on the penalty shootout, there was certainly more than one penalty where the player is stuttering his run, but not with any sort of confidence to stutter around. If you stutter your run, in my mind, you have to keep your eyes on the goalkeeper the whole time. So you've got to be confident enough in your ability to not look at the ball. Mm. Because then if you suddenly look down at the ball, then you don't know. The whole idea is you're making the keeper go when you roll it into the other corner. If you're not good enough, pick a corner or get your head over it and smash the bloody thing.
Well, also to do that, with the pressure that must be on you at that moment, those players who do that, I don't know whether it's just hardwired into them, that's the way they take penalties and they don't change. Sometimes you do see the odd penalty where you just know that they've just thought, there's no way I'm going to do anything but just absolutely smash it here, usually a defender. But that's a really difficult skill, that to actually wait for the goalkeeper to go and then play it the other way, because it's kind of... You're asking your body to do something in a split second.
And if the keeper doesn't move,
then
what do you do? Your foot's there, it's coming towards the ball. What do you do? Going back to the start, Oliver writes, just one observation. Knudsen has been trying those long throws at Ipswich with absolutely no success. And the first time he does one at a World Cup, it goes in, from a very frustrated Town fan. And then Kieran said Denmark forgot the all-important proverb that next 5 minutes, nothing stupid. Exactly right when Croatia came back into it. Felix asks, what do you think of Schmeichel's short sleeves? I'm aware that short sleeve goalkeepers had a good day today. I'm aware of Casillas and Buffon. It doesn't mean I trust any of them.
It was also about 28 degrees in the evening there, so I'd have wanted short sleeves on.
And John says, Mandzukic appears to have grown a beard during the game. Is this normal if games go to extra time? For the hirsute gentleman, I would say absolutely. How do we view Croatia now in this tournament? Do we say they're as good as they were in the group stages, or do we overrate their victory over Argentina because Argentina, it turns out, aren't very good? Or was this an aberration and actually they are the favourites on this side of the draw to make the final?
I don't think you have to play great in every game. Like, I don't think you have to do that to be a good team. Like, I mean, it springs to mind because, yeah, my own allegiances, but Italy in 2006 had a very bad game against Australia.
Then Grosso dived.
We talked about this off air. It's definitely 100% a foul. In any case, yeah, had a bad game against Australia, went on to win the whole thing. So for me, there's a little bit... potentially, if it becomes this to them, this could be a real liberation moment for Croatia. Because actually, at Euro 2016, we all was talking about Croatia as a team that could really go somewhere. And they came out the group stage and they ran into Portugal and they had this sort of really disappointing performance and lost in extra time. And this time, especially after Modric has the penalty saved, you can sort of feel all those demons creeping back in, that this team that's their sort of golden generation is going to find a way to not get through the first hurdle again in the knockout stage.
I think they'll take so much from the fact that they did find a way in the end, and they'll look back and think, well, okay, Modric, that pass he played for Kramaric, maybe Kramaric should have caught the trigger and won the game before it got to that point. But I think they'll have learnt from that game. Well, the coach should have, anyway. And also, I do wonder if Mandzukic might start in the next game. He took a knock, looked very leggy in the second half, and he is getting on a bit. And maybe it...
He's weighed down by his beard.
Yeah. He usually ends a game with blood on his body somewhere as well, and he didn't. It's just a bit disappointing.
We also have to mention Luka Modric. It reminded me a little bit, and it's more important here than... When Harry Kane missed that penalty against Liverpool in the 92nd minute at Anfield and then scored one in the 94th, to stand up again, having missed a penalty, and score one in the shootout, it didn't seem like
and
a great penalty.
Miss again in
almost
the
miss it again. But you imagine, you must be thinking in your mind, maybe it doesn't go to elite sportsmen's heads like it would mine, but if you've missed one, you can't miss a... I mean, that the thought of missing another one means I just wouldn't take one.
That's where you benefit from having a multiple Champions League winner taking it, I suppose. And they've played in those games before, and they've taken penalties under great pressure before. So that's why he's their captain, I suppose.
So Croatia, Russia. I mean, Russia can't, but can they? I mean, couldn't they?
You look at what Denmark did against Croatia tonight, and Russia probably of a similar quality. Obviously, they've got the whole nation behind them, and yeah, lots of support. But I think they'll be on such a high they wouldn't have expected to get here. They maybe play with a little bit more freedom now they've got to the quarterfinals. But I also think Croatia will have learned from that performance against Denmark, and maybe will be rejigged somewhat so they can get Rakitic and Modric on the ball more than they were in that game.
All right, that'll do for part two. In part three, we'll look ahead to tomorrow's games, Mexico-Brazil and Japan-Belgium. Welcome to part three of the Guardian World Cup Football Daily. Let's look ahead to tomorrow's games, the early kickoff. Mexico play Brazil. Let's talk to our Mexican football expert, Tom Marshall, who's out in Russia. Tom, how are you doing?
Yeah, good. Obviously, pretty crazy over here with the Russia win and then here in Samara and the Mexico fans, the Brazil fans. So imagine the atmosphere is pretty amazing tonight.
You're in the difficult side of the draw, Mexico.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, I don't think anybody's looking really past Brazil. Obviously, Mexico going into the game was pretty huge underdogs. Mexico, it's like a statistical, it's almost a freak, really, that Mexico have reached the round of 16 in the last six World Cups. This is the seventh. And yet they've lost every single one of the round of 16 games. So you can imagine, you know, within the country, it's like this game tomorrow against Brazil, it's the World Cup final for Mexico. I mean, that's how much it means. And if Mexico can do it, then obviously it's going to break that record of always going out with the round of 16, seemingly. So, yeah, absolutely huge game for Mexico, but it's not going to be easy against a Brazil team that has looked pretty good so far.
Yeah, I just wondered that. Brazil haven't shone like we expected they might. I wonder if the Mexican press and the Mexican fans are taking a little bit of hope from that.
Yeah, I think more than anything, the hope for Mexico comes from the fact that, all right, Mexico have never beaten Brazil at a World Cup, but 2012 Olympics, you know, Thiago Silva played for Brazil, Neymar played for Brazil, and Mexico beat him in Wembley. So they won the gold medal, and Brazil were pretty desperate for that, to win that medal. And then, you know, at youth level as well, Mexico tend to do well against Brazil. And I think more than anything, kind of style-wise, we saw Sweden cause Mexico a lot of problems with a, you know, physical, direct game. And I think that, you know, on paper, Brazil's style shouldn't cause Mexico as many problems. But then again, when you've got the individual quality that Brazil have, you know, it's going to take a huge game for Mexico to get something. But yeah, I mean, there's quiet confidence within Mexico. I've been to the hotel tonight, and you know, they obviously know that this generation of Mexican players as well. You've got Chicharito, 30 years old, Ochoa, Andres Guardado, Hector Herrera. I mean, really, this is the last World Cup with those players in the prime. And I think there's really, they know that the game against Brazil is an opportunity to make history. And to be honest, there's not that much to lose. I mean, if Mexico can do it, it's going to be, you know, it's going to be massive, but most people are expecting Mexico to go out. So really, not much to lose for Mexico.
Tom, it was interesting you said that about it perhaps being a better matchup in some ways, a team like Brazil and a team like Sweden. I know Osorio spoke about that after the loss to Sweden, that in his view, Latin American teams all struggle to play against that sort of direct game, the very sort of physical, I guess, what is stereotypically a Northern European approach of playing the ball direct, using physicality like that. But is there something in the psychology of this game? I've heard people talking about, especially now that we've seen Germany go out, Spain go out, England having teams that they have like a psychological fear of. That there are teams that, because they've sort of been beaten by them in the past, because they've had long histories with them, they just view as superior, and that can affect them. Does Mexico maybe have some of that with Brazil? Because while they're not actually in the same qualifying section, you still have that that closeness physically and perhaps more of a rivalry than everyone in Europe would know about.
Yeah, I think I don't think it's Mexico go against Brazil and they kind of feel, you know, inferior. I think realistic, I mean, player for player, Mexico isn't as good, but I just think that the Mexican team feels that, yeah, like you said, style wise that Brazil are much better suited to Mexico than a Northern European team. But I know Osorio, I mean, I was very surprised against Sweden that Osorio didn't change the lineup, because what he usually does against those teams is he plays with a back three and then a kind of holding midfielder who's good in the air. And I think he kind of almost betrayed himself. And I mean, I think he was really beat himself up about it after that game, because he's the manager, he's the Latin American manager that does adapt his system to depending on the opposition. So, but yeah, I think in terms of the game against Brazil, yeah, it is what it is. Mexico know that underdogs, if Neymar's on form, if Coutinho starts, you know, playing the ball around, then they can be in trouble. But I also think with the underdog status, I think quite a lot of the upsets we've seen are caused by teams that are very good defensively and they sit back. You know, we saw Russia, they sit back, they kind of, you know, and kind of park the bus in a way, looking for the set pieces, looking for a counter-attack. And Mexico isn't that team. And I think this is one of the... I'm not sure if it's a problem, because I think Mexican players only know they're very good in possession, very technically, and they're good going forward. And so I don't think culturally within the Mexican game there's that kind of... There aren't teams in the league, for example, that sit back and defend for 90 minutes. But I think that's the fear. You know, if Mexico play a really open game, which they definitely will, they're going to press Brazil high up, they're going to try and have possession. The worry is that at the back, they'll get picked off by, obviously, Brazil's amazing talents up front.
Give us a score prediction, Tom.
I'll have to go 2-1 Brazil. I think it's going to be a good game, though.
All right. Thanks for your time, as always.
Cheers.
Tom Marshall there, Mexican football expert. Looking at Brazil, Greg, Coutinho's actually played very well. We didn't really mention him a lot in the last game, and we probably should have done. He seems to be more of a talisman for Brazil currently than Neymar.
Yeah, definitely is. He's been the best player by far in this tournament, and he's the one who has found a way to create things when the other players haven't been able to do that. He's scored goals as well, and he looks like he's really grown into himself in this tournament and looks like the player Barcelona signed for all that money. He's just so creative. He can find a pass when nothing appears to be on. And in some ways, maybe he could get a little bit more assistance from the forwards. I don't think he's really clicked with Gabriel Jesus yet. They should possibly think about Firmino starting instead of him, because I think again, we were talking about centre-forwards who bring shape to a team. I think he could do that with Brazil. He could do a lot of the running that maybe Neymar doesn't do.
I would put Firmino in ahead of Jesus or Neymar.
Well, also, he's got the understanding with Coutinho from his relationship with him at Liverpool. So I just think, why wouldn't you play on that? And we were talking before about using those club understandings. I know he's at a different team now, but he's been training and playing football with Coutinho for a long time, so why not bring him in and give him a go instead of Gabriel Jesus?
There is one thing that I can't remember who it was I saw this from that was brought to my attention with the Brazil and why maybe Firmino hasn't been used as much here, and it goes back to qualifying, and essentially it's the idea that Neymar is out there on the left, and for Liverpool, Firmino likes to drift left, and so that works great for Liverpool because Salah then exploits the space on the right, whereas with Neymar, they end up treading each other's toes. I mean, you get into this point a little bit where you're like, yeah, but I mean, I agree with Greg, Firmino and Coutinho, use that to your advantage, but you know, I suppose like everything, like PSG, when Neymar's in your team, you feel like you have to do everything around him, which I'm not always sure is to your biggest advantage.
Fluid movement up front as well. I mean, okay, Neymar likes to be on the left, but I think like when Croatia have been at their best, their forwards have switched, Rebic and Perisic as well, and just drag players around and give Coutinho constant opportunities to slide the ball through.
Sort of like Ali, Lingard and Sterling, just... predictions for this one. I would say you can't see Mexico beating Brazil, but in this World Cup, frankly, anything could happen. And Mexico have beaten Germany already, haven't they?
This is the round of Mexico, isn't it? It's like Arsenal's, the last 16, the Champions League was a round of Arsenal. They don't go further than the last 16. And I think 6 World Cups on the bounce, they've gone out at this stage. So I think I'll stick with the round of Mexico and Brazil will go through.
Same for you.
You know, I was going to go with Brazil, but I feel like as Greg has given that exact rationale, I've been going, yeah, but all of our preconceptions being upturned, and Tom already went with the Brazil win, so just to be contrary, let's say Mexico win.
Mexico tend to be really entertaining in the last 16, though. I remember going back to the 2006 World Cup, they had an absolute barnstorming last 16 game with Portugal, I think it was, and they just tend to be entertaining at this level, so yeah, the one to watch tomorrow.
Yeah, it hopefully will be the most open game, or hopefully more open than France Argentina. Japan Belgium, let's begin by looking at Japan, how they're going into this game. Let's talk to the Gary Lineker of Japanese television, Ben Mabley. Ben, how are you doing?
I'm very well, very well. Always honoured to be introduced in such a kind way by you, Ben. I mean, you are misleading the listeners a little bit, but I appreciate it nonetheless.
I followed both of your footballing careers with exactly the same interest when I was growing up, Ben. The Japanese have been doing some soul-searching, haven't they, since that weird final game against Poland when they were just wandering about, completing passes like nobody's business.
Yeah, that's kind of dominated the story ever since Japan got through, you know. The samurai blue, they like to have this samurai spirit, and fair play is very much a big part of that. And so if you ask people before the tournament started, or even before the final game started, would it be all right to go through on the fair play rule? I think a lot of people would have seen the sense in that and thought that was actually quite appropriate. But then for the way it played out, of course, you know, just passing it around for 10 minutes without either team trying to attack or anything. Is this really fair play? It seemed a little bit ironic, perhaps even oxymoronic. And so that's kind of dominated the stories a little bit. But if you look back in Japanese football history in their pre-professional days, the biggest thing that's ever happened to Japan is getting the bronze medal at the 1968 Olympics. And they did a similar thing in their final group game there to play out a mutually convenient 0-0 draw. So, you know, when the tournament set up this way, you have to play to the rules sometimes.
Did the Japanese fans want Belgium or want England?
Well, yeah, you see, this is the problem now. They're in the difficult half of the draw, so they can't get the easy route to the final. I don't think anybody in Japan has thought about it in that context. The context that more people have been thinking about it is this is only the third time that Japan have ever played in the last 16 of the World Cup. And in the previous two, it was against Turkey in 2002 on home soil, and then against Paraguay in South Africa in 2010. This is the first time that really Japan have had the chance to play a knockout game against one of the supposed contenders for the actual title. So in that sense, they didn't really mind whether it was going to be Belgium or England. It was a good opportunity to finally play a big team, a favoured team at this stage of the tournament. And maybe some people would have preferred England just because of the historical aspect. But really, I don't think beggars could be choosers, if that's a fair enough expression.
The Japanese haven't been practising penalties, have they?
No, this is one of the things that's made the headlines from Nishino's, the manager's, press conference today. He said that although some individuals, for their own peace of mind, have been practicing penalties by themselves, there's been no attempt as a squad, as a team, to practice for a penalty shootout situation. He believes that it's entirely pointless. You cannot recreate the tension, the pressure of the tournament situation. So why bother? I'm not sure that's necessarily a particularly progressive way of thinking, but I suppose maybe it's quite optimistic for the Japanese media to be thinking that far ahead. I think the team are probably more concentrated on the 90 minutes, first of all.
I noticed that Nishino changed his team a little bit for that game against Poland. Kagawa came out of the side. I think Inui came out of the side as well. Players who had a bit of an influence in the first two games. Is that going to be a change back, or is this sort of a squad that's still, I don't know, in flux going into this game?
Yeah, that was kind of a mystery. It was a surprise to see as many as six changes to the lineup, wasn't it? I think it's most likely, and most people are certainly expecting, that Japan are going to go back to the lineup that played the first two games, certainly the bulk of them. But something that Nishino, as he said in his first press conference as Japan manager just 2 months ago, and repeated again yesterday, is the expression he likes. He says chemical reaction. He wants to cause a chemical reaction within the team, which I suppose, to put another way, is like making it more than the sum of its parts. The previous manager, Halil Hodžić, was more about individual battles. Nishino thinks the only way for them to succeed is to try and develop something as a team. And, you know, they've only played three friendlies and three competitive matches now together. And so if we do believe in this concept of the team idea, and they're putting a lot of faith into this, then they should be getting stronger with each passing match, just because there's been so few of them. And yeah, it's expected that he'll go back to the bulk of the lineup that played the first two games, but you know, he did place faith in the squad, and he's been quite pragmatic as to the needs of the situation, both with the lineup and of course with the last 10 minutes of the game the other day.
The other thing I had to ask, Ben, is that I saw today that Belgium's official English language Twitter account was tweeting Adnan Januzaj, seemingly talking up not the Japanese footballer Shinji Kagawa, but the wrestler Shinsuke Nakamura, who they somehow managed to mix up neatly on that. I wonder if that had made any news over there, or if that's just slid by.
Personally, I haven't heard that. I don't know if it has made news elsewhere in Japan, but certainly there has been this impression from Belgium that they are kind of overlooking Japan a little bit. maybe been a little bit complacent about this tie. I mean, they played a friendly just last year, and Martinez was referring to that in his press conference too, and saying that he learned about Japan then and didn't seem to believe that Japan had changed all that much. Well, they've changed their manager since then, they've changed their style of play, and they've changed a lot of the players. So if he's relying on knowledge that he gained a year ago, then it may not be up to date. It may suggest that they haven't quite done their research on the current Japan team, and that could be to Japan's advantage.
Well, Ben, we wish all of Japan good luck tomorrow.
Thank you very much indeed. Nice to speak to you again.
Always good to speak to you, Ben Mabley there. Belgium, we expect them to go through without any problem. If they don't, it means that Gareth Southgate was absolutely right. They have played very well in this tournament in the same way that England have, and then we sort of discount the England-Belgium game, Paolo, don't we?
Yeah, I mean, the England-Belgium game, I don't think, told us an awful lot. It was interesting to hear Eden Hazard interviewed at his press conference ahead of this game, saying, first of all, oh, yeah, it was nice that we had a long season, us Premier League players, to have the extra rest. But then he also said at the same time, sometimes when I get left out for a game, it disrupts my rhythm, and when I come back, I'm not as good in that next game, which is a bit of a thing for him to say, actually. I thought it's a little bit provocative, and
hang on, he just hasn't played in a game, doesn't, you know, like, it's as if there was only, if so if there was 3 days between games, he would be out of sync. But if he had 7 days and there was no fixture,
maybe after
would he be
3 days,
out of sync?
He's just walking down the street and he's doing step overs and like, kind of jumping up and
total muscle memory.
And it's just his body just goes mad and
he's
going to do something.
Devastated about the winter break if he stays at Chelsea, isn't he? Does anyone give Japan a hope there?
Not really.
No, I don't think so, I'm afraid.
Neither do I.
Maybe if the same players met when they were 50 years old, Japan would win, because you just seem to age so well. And there's so, I did the Japan previews beforehand, going through them and subbing them and whatnot. And there's the Legends team. There are so many of those players who are in the late 40s, and one particular player is in his early 50s, and they're still playing professional football.
Are you serious?
Yeah, it's amazing. It's the diet. It's the diet.
Okay, but in 50 years' time, you know, these guys will be older than 50, won't they?
Yeah. Okay. Maybe I've over-egged that. I think I've had a long stint on the minute by minute.
We'll finish with the reaction to the shithousery 11. We struggle with fullbacks, I guess. This one is from Paul, who says, I can't believe you named a shithousery 11 with no sign of that absolute... Oh, he's so rude about Stefan Lischteiner. He says, absolute arse. Alves at right back instead of that colossal bleep. Lischteiner, should he be in this team?
Yeah, I think that's a good shout. I think he's absolutely fitting the mood of this team.
Very politely put. The Cedar Room says, with the World Cup all-time shithousery 11, you need to also go back in time to some older World Cups for some candidates. One that springs to mind is from the infamous Battle of Santiago in the 1962 World Cup. The Chilean forward, Lionel Sanchez, must be a candidate for punching two different Italians in the head and getting away with it. Evil Londaria says, Otamendi has to be the captain. He could have killed two players in this tournament. He absolutely wellied the ball into both Rakitic and Pogba as they lay on the ground. He's a dirty, cowardly punk. Ollie says, I remember Gabriel Heinze jumping in front of a referee and linesman against Mexico
Heinze
in 2010.
Heinze is a great shout for a fullback.
Yeah. I was thinking Heinze as possible.
Is Rivaldo in there as well?
Yeah, Rivaldo. Yeah, Rivaldo and Maradona are just in front of Simeone. Okay. So Heinze jumped in front of a referee and a linesman against Mexico in 2010, so they couldn't look at a big screen to see if Argentina's goal was offside, which it was by yards. And T. Kirk says, I hope Nigel de Jong would at least get honourable mention. We did completely forget that one challenge by Nigel de Jong. And Ben says, after the shithousery 11, can we have a universally liked 11, please? Company, Matter and Zola to start off. We can, but not tonight, because it's gone 11 p.m. And frankly, Denmark and Croatia should have thought about that and not going to extra time and penalties. We don't mind it in the first game. Absolutely fine for Brazil and Mexico to go all the way. But frankly, Japan and Belgium, if you're listening, do it in 90 minutes. Thank you for your time, Greg.
Thank you.
Thank you, Paolo.
Cheers.
We'll be back tomorrow.
Football. For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.